even to the kingdom of Iguil Warthon in his Salome, where reigned Beren and Tenuviel her daughter. Now Beren and Tenuviel lived not in any settled abode, nor had their realm boundaries well marked, and no other messenger save Gwendolen, daughter of the Varley, had of a surety found those twain the living dead so soon. It is clear from the manuscript that the return of Mablung and Huan to Artenor and their presence at the hunt, referred to in general terms at the end of the tale of Tenuviel, page 41, was added to the tale, and with this new element went the change in Gwendolen's movements immediately after the disaster. But though the textual history is here extremely hard to interpret, what with erasures and additions on loose pages, I think it is almost certain that this reshaping was done while the original composition of the tale was still in progress. End of note. Indeed, the tale tells that even as that host of the orcs were burning all the land of Tinwellant, and the Naugloth and the Indrafangin were wending homeward, burdened utterly with spoils of gold and precious things, came Huan to Beren's lodge, and it was dusk. Though Beren sat upon a tree root, and Tenuviel danced on a green sward in the gloaming as he gazed upon her, when suddenly stood Huan before them, and Beren gave a cry of joy and wonder, for it was long since he and Huan had hunted together. But Tenuviel, looking upon Huan, saw that he bled, and there was a tale to read in his great eyes. And said she suddenly, "What evil then has fallen upon Artenor?" And Huan said, "Fire and death and the terror of orcs, but Tinwellant is slain." Then did both Beren and Tenuviel weep bitter tears, nor did the full tale of Huan dry their eyes. When then it was told to the end, leapt Beren to his feet in white wrath, and seizing a horn that hung at his belt, he blew a clear blast thereon that rang round all the neighboring hills, and an elfin folk, all clad in green and brown, sprang as it were by magic towards him from every glade and coppice, stream and fell. Now not even Beren knew the tale of those myriad folk that followed his horn in the woods of Hisalome. And or ever the moon was high above the hills, the host assembled in the glade of his abiding was very great. Yet were they lightly armed, and the most bore only knives and bows. "Yet," said Beren, "speed is that which now we need the most." And certain elves at his bidding fared like deer before him, seeking news of the march of the dwarves and Indrafangs. But at dawn he followed at the head of the green elves, and Tenuviel abode in the glade and wept unto herself for the death of Tinwellant. And Gwendolen also she mourned as dead. Now is to tell that the laden host of the dwarves fared from the place of their ransacking, and now Glaudor was at their head, and beside him Ufethan and Bodruith. And ever as he rode, Ufethan sought to put the dread eyes of Gwendolen from his mind, and could not. And all happiness was fled from his heart that shriveled under the memory of that glance. Nor was this the only disquiet that tortured him, for if ever he raised his eyes, lo, they lighted on the necklace of the dwarves shining about the aged neck of Naugloddur. And then all other thoughts save bottomless desire of its beauty were banished. Thus did those three fare, and with them all their host. But so great became the torment of Ufethan's mind, that in the end he might not endure it more. But at night, when a halt was called, he crept stealthily to the place where Naugloddur slept, and coming upon that aged one wrapped in slumbers, would slay that dwarf and lay hands upon the wondrous Naugloffring. Now even as he sought to do so, behold, one seized his throat suddenly from behind, and it was Bodruith, who, filled with the same lust, sought also to make that lovely thing his own. But coming upon Ufethan, would slay him by reason of his kinship to Naugloddur. Then did Ufethan stab suddenly backward at hazard in the dark with a keen knife long and slender that he had with him for the bane of Naugloddur. And that knife pierced the vitals of Bodruith, lord of Belagost, so that he fell dying upon Naugloddur, and the throat of Naugloddur and the magic carcanet were drenched anew with blood. Thereat did Naugloddur awake with a great cry, but Ufethan fled gasping from that place, for the long fingers of the Indrafang had well nigh choked him. Now when some bore torches swiftly to that place, Naugloddur thought that Bodruith alone had sought to rob him of the jewel, and marveled how he had thus been timely slain, and he proclaimed a rich reward to the slayer of Bodruith, if that man would come forward telling all that he had seen. Thus was it that none perceived the flight of Ufethan for a while, and wrath awoke between the dwarves of Nogrod and the Indrafons, and many were slain ere the Indrafons, being in less number, were scattered and got them as best they might to Belagost, bearing scant treasury with them. Of this came the age-long feud between those kindreds of the dwarves that has spread to many lands and caused many a tale, whereof the elves know little tidings and men have seldom heard. Yet may it be seen how the curse of Mim came early home to rest among his own kin, and would indeed it had gone no further, and had visited the Eldar nevermore. Lo, when the flight of Ufethan came also to light, then was now Glaudur in wrath. And he let kill all the gnomes that remained in the host. Then said he, "Now are we rid of Indrafangs and gnomes and all traitors, and naught more do I fear at all." But Ufethan ranged the wild lands in great fear and anguish. For him seemed that he had become a traitor to his kin, blood guilty to the elves, and haunted with the (burning in brackets) eyes of Gwendolen the queen. For naught but exile and misery, and no smallest part nor share had he in the gold of Glorin. For all his heart was afire with lust, yet few have pitied him. Now tells the tale that he fell in with the rangers of Beren's folk, and these gaining from him sure knowledge of all the host and array of Nauglodur and the ways he purposed to follow, they sped back like wind among the trees unto their lord. But Ufethan revealed not to them who he was, feigning to be an elf of Artenor, escaped from bondage in their host. Now therefore they entreated him well, and he was sent back to Beren that their captain might, Lacuna, his words. And albeit Beren marveled at his, (cowardly in brackets, Lacuna, and downward glance it seemed to him that he brought safe word, and he set a trap for Nauglodur. Note 14. The first of these lacunae that I have left in the text contains two words, the first possibly believe, and the second probably best. In the second lacuna, the word might conceivably be pallor. End of note. No longer did he march hotly on the trail of the dwarves, but knowing that they would assay the passage of the river Aros at a certain time, he turned aside, faring swiftly with his light-footed elves by straighter paths that he might reach Sarnothrod, the stony ford before them. Now the Aros is a fierce stream, and is it not that very water that more near its spring runs swiftly past the aged doors of the Rodothlim's caves and the dark lairs of Glorind? Note 15. This sentence from "and is it not that very water" is struck through and bracketed, and in the margin my father scribbled, "No, that in brackets, is Narog." End of note. And in those lower regions by no means can be crossed by a great host of laden men, save at this ford, nor is it over easy here. Never would Nauglodur have taken that way, had he knowledge of Beren. Yet blinded by the spell and the dazzling gold, he feared naught either within or without his host. And he was in haste to reach Nogrod in its dark caverns, for the dwarves list not long to abide in the bright light of day. Now came all that host to the banks of Aros, and their array was thus. First a number of unladen dwarves most fully armed, and amidmost the great company of those that bore the treasury of Glorind, and many a fair thing beside that they had hailed from Tinwellen's halls. And behind these was now Glaudur, and he bestrode Tinwellen's horse. And a strange figure did he seem, for the legs of the dwarves are short and crooked. But two dwarves led that horse, for it went not willingly, and it was laden with spoil. But behind these came again a mass of armed men, but little laden. And in this array they sought to cross Sarnothrod on their day of doom. Morn was it when they reached the hither bank, and high noon saw them yet passing in long strong lines, and wading slowly the shallow places of the swift-running stream. Here doth it widen out and fare down narrow channels filled with boulders between long spits of shingle and stones less great. Now did Nauglodur slip from his burdened horse and prepare to get him over, for the armed host of the vanguard had climbed already the further bank, and it was great and sheer and thick with trees, and the bearers of the gold were some already stepped thereon and some amidmost of the stream, but the armed men of the rear were resting a while. Suddenly is all that place filled with the sound of elfin horns, and one, illegible, with a clearer blast above the rest, and it is the horn of Beren, the huntsman of the woods. Note 16. The illegible word might be braze. The word clearer is an emendation from hoarser. End of note. Then is the air thick with the slender arrows of the Eldar that err not, neither doth the wind bear them aside. And lo, from every tree and boulder do the brown elves and the green springs suddenly and loose unceasingly from full quivers. Then was there a panic and a noise in the hosts of Nauglodur, and those that waded in the ford cast their golden burdens in the waters and sought affrighted to either bank. And many were stricken with those pitiless darts, and fell with their gold into the currents of the Aros, staining its clear waters with their dark blood. Now were the warriors on the far bank, question mark wrapped, in brackets, in battle, and rallying sought to come at their foes. But these fled nimbly before them, while, question mark others, in brackets, poured still the hail of arrows upon them, and thus got the Eldar few hurts, and the dwarf folk fell dead unceasingly. Now was that great fight of the stony ford, Lacuna, nigh to Nauglodur. For even though Nauglodur and his captains led their band stoutly, never might they grip their foe. And death fell like rain upon their ranks, and for the most part broke and fled. And a noise of clear laughter echoed from the elves thereat, and they forbore to shoot more, for the ill-shapen figures of the dwarves as they fled, their white beards torn by the wind, filled them with, in brackets, mirth. But now stood Nauglodur, and few were about him. And he remembered the words of Gwendolen, for behold, Beren came towards him, and he cast aside his bow, and drew a bright sword. And Beren was of great stature among the Eldar, albeit not of the girth and breadth of Nauglodur of the dwarves. Then said Beren, ward thy life, and thou canst, O crook-legged murderer, else will I take it. And Nauglodur bid him even the Nauglofring, the necklace of wonder, that he be suffered to go unharmed. But Beren said, nay, that may I still take when thou art slain. And thereat he made a loan upon Nauglodur and his companions. And having slain the foremost of these, the others fled away amid elfin laughter. And so Beren came upon Nauglodur, slayer of Tinwellant. Then did that aged one defend himself doughtily, and was a bitter fight. And many of the elves that watched for love and fear of their captain fingered their bowstrings. But Beren called even as he fought that all should stay their hands. Now little doth the tale tell of wounds and blows of that affray, save that Beren got many hurts therein, and many of his shrewdest blows did little harm to Nauglodur by reason of the question mark skill brackets and magic of his dwarfen mail. And it is said that 3 hours they fought, and Beren's arms grew weary, but not those of Nauglodur accustomed to wield his mighty hammer at the forge. And it is more than like that otherwise would the issue have been, but for the curse of Mim. For marking how Beren grew faint, Nauglodur pressed him ever more nearly. And the arrogance that was of that grievous spell came into his heart, and he thought, I will slay this elf, and his folk will flee in fear before thee. And grasping his sword, he dealt a mighty blow, and cried, take here thy bane, O stripling of the woods! And in that moment his foot found a jagged stone, and he stumbled forward. But Beren slipped aside from that blow, and catching at his beard, his hand found the carcanet of gold, and therewith he swung Nauglodur suddenly off his feet upon his face. And Nauglodur's sword was shaken from his grasp, but Beren seized it and slew him therewith. For he said, I will not sully my bright blade with thy dark blood, since there is no need. But the body of Nauglodur was cast into the Aros. Then did he unloose the necklace, and he gazed in wonder at it, and beheld the Silmaril, even the jewel he won from Angband, and gained undying glory by his deed. And he said, never have mine eyes beheld thee, O lamp of faery, burn one half so fair as now thou dost, set in gold and gems and the magic of the dwarves. And that necklace he caused to be washed of its stains, and he cast it not away, knowing naught of its power, but bore it with him back into the woods of Hithlum. for the waters of Aros flowed on forever above the drowned horde of Glorin, and so do still, for in after days dwarves came from Nogrod and sought for it, and for the body of Noglodur. But a flood arose from the mountains, and therein the seekers perished, and so great now is the gloom and dread of that stony ford, that none seek the treasure that it guards, nor dare ever to cross the magic stream at that enchanted place. But in the vales of Hithlum was there gladness at the homecoming of the elves, and great was the joy of Tenuvial to see her lord once more returning amidst his companies. But little did it ease her grief for the death of Tinwellant, that now Glodder was slain and many dwarves beside. Then did Beren seek to comfort her, and taking her in his arms, he set the glorious Naglofring about her neck, and all were blinded by the greatness of her beauty. And Beren said, "Behold the lamp of Feanor, that thou and I did win from Hel." And Tenuvial smiled, remembering the first days of their love, and those days of travail in the wild. End of side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 9, The Book of Lost Tales, Part 2, by J.R.R. Tolkien, continuing on page 239. Now it is to be said that Beren sent for Ufethan, and well rewarded him for his words of true guidance, whereof the dwarves had been overcome, and he bid him dwell in Lacuna, among his folk. And Ufethan was little loath. Yet on a time, no great space thereafter, did that thing betide which he least desired. For came there a sound of very sorrowful singing in the woods, and behold, it was Gwendolen wandering distraught, and her feet bore her to the midmost of a glade where sat Beren and Tenuvial. And at that hour it was new morning, but at the sound all nigh ceased their speaking and were very still. Then did Beren gaze in awe upon Gwendolen, but Tenuvial cried suddenly in sorrow mixed with joy, "O mother Gwendolen, whither do thy feet bear thee, for methought thee dead?" But the greeting of those twain upon the greensward was very sweet, and Ufethan fled from among the elves, for he could not endure to look upon the eyes of Gwendolen. And madness took him, and none may say what was his unhappy weird thereafter. And little but a tortured heart got he from the gold of Glorin. Now hearing the cries of Ufethan, Gwendolen looked in wonder after him, and stayed her tender words. And memory came back into her eyes, so that she cried as in amaze, beholding the necklace of the dwarves that hung about the white throat of Tenuvial. Then wrathfully she asked of Beren what it might portend, and wherefore he suffered the accursed thing to touch Tenuvial, and told Beren all that tale such as Huan had told him in deed or guess, and of the pursuit and fighting at the ford he told also, saying at the end, "Nor indeed do I see who, now that Lord Tinwellant is fared to Valinor, should so fittingly wear that jewel of the gods as Tenuvial." Note 17. And told Beren, that is, and Beren told. The text as first written had, "then told Beren." End of note. But Gwendolen told of the dragon's ban upon the gold, and the ? Staining in brackets of blood in the king's halls. And yet another and more potent curse, whose arising I know not, is woven therewith, said she. Nor methinks was the labor of the dwarves free from spells of the most enduring malice.
But Beren laughed, saying that the glory of the Silmaril and its holiness might overcome all such evils, even as it burnt the ? Fowl in brackets flesh of Carcharus. Nor, said he, have I seen ever my Tenuvial so fair as now she is, clasped in the loveliness of this thing of gold.
But Gwendolen said, yet the Silmaril abode in the crown of Melko, and that is the work of baleful smiths indeed. Then said Tenuvial that she desired not things of worth or precious stones, but the elfin gladness of the forest. And to pleasure Gwendolen she cast it from her neck. But Beren was little pleased, and he would not suffer it to be flung away, but warded it in his illegible. Note 18. The illegible word might just possibly be treasury, but I do not think that it is. End of note. Thereafter did Gwendolen abide a while in the woods among them, and was healed. And in the end she fared wistfully back to the land of Lorien, and came never again into the tales of the dwellers of earth.
But upon Beren and Tenuvial fell swiftly that doom of mortality that Mondos had spoken when he sped them from his halls. And in this, perhaps, did the curse of Mime have, potency in brackets, in that it came more soon upon them. Nor this time did those twain fare the road together, but when yet was the child of those twain, Dior the fair, a little one, did Tenuvial slowly fade, even as the elves of later days have done throughout the world. And she vanished in the woods, and none have seen her dancing ever there again. Note 19. Dior replaced the name Ausir, which, however, occurs below as another name for Dior. End of note. But Beren searched all the lands of Hithlum and of Artanor, ranging after her. And never has any of the elves had more loneliness than his, or ever he too faded from life. And Dior his son was left ruler of the brown elves and the green, and lord of the Nauglofring. Mayhap what all elves say is true, that those twain hunt now in the forest of Orome in Valinor, and Tenuvial dances on the green swards of Nessa and of Varna, daughters of the gods, for evermore. Yet great was the grief of the elves when the Gwyl Warthun went from among them, and being leaderless and lessened of magic, their numbers minished. And many fared away to Gondolin, the rumor of whose growing power and glory ran in secret whispers among all the elves. Still did Dior, when come to manhood, rule a numerous folk, and he loved the woods even as Beren had done. And songs name him mostly Ausir the Wealthy, for his possession of that wondrous gem set in the necklace of the dwarves. Now the tales of Beren and Tenuvial grew dim in his heart, and he took to wearing it about his neck, and to love its loveliness most dearly. And the fame of that jewel spread like fire through all the regions of the north, and the elves said one to another, "A Silmaril of Feanor burns in the woods of Hisalome." Now fare the long days of Elfinesse unto that time when Tuor dwelt in Gondolin. And children then had Dior the elf, Aurevir and Elwing, and Aurevir was most like to his forefather Beren, and all loved him, yet none so dearly as did Dior. Note 20. Dior the Elf is an emendation from Dior, then an aged elf. End of note. But Elwing the Fairy, of all poesies named as beautiful as Tenuvial, if that indeed may be, yet hard is it to say, seeing the great loveliness of the elfin folk of yore. Now those were days of happiness in the vales of Hithlum, for there was peace with Melko and the dwarves, who had but one thought as they plotted against Gondolin, and Angband was full of labor. Yet is it to tell that bitterness entered into the hearts of the seven sons of Feanor, remembering their oath. Now Maedhros, whom Melko maimed, was their leader, and he called to his brethren Moglor and Dinithil, and to Damrod and to Caligorm, to Cronthor and to Curifin the Crafty, and he said to them how it was now known to him that a Silmaril of those their father Feanor had made was now the pride and glory of Dior of the Southern Vales. And Elwing, his daughter, bears it whither so she goes. "But do you not forget," said he, "that we swore to have no peace with Melko, nor any of his folk, nor with any other of earth-dwellers that held the Silmarils of Feanor from us? For what," said Maedhros, "do we suffer exile and wandering and rule over a scant and forgotten folk, if others gather to their hoard the heirlooms that are ours?" Thus was it that they sent Curufin the Crafty to Dior and told him of their oath, and bid him give that fair jewel back unto those whose right it was. But Dior, gazing on the loveliness of Elwing, would not do so, and he said that he could not endure that the Nauglofring, fairest of earthly craft, to be so despoiled. "Then," said Curufin, "must the Nauglofring unbroken be given to the sons of Feanor?" And Dior waxed wroth, bidding him begone, nor dare to claim what his sire Beren, the one-handed, won with his hand from the jaws, in brackets, of Melko. "Other twain are there in the self-same place," said he, "and your hearts be bold enow." Then went Curufin unto his brethren, and because of their unbreakable oath, and of their first, in brackets, for that Silmaril, nor indeed was the spell of Mim and of the dragon wanting, they planned war upon Dior, and the Eldar cries shame upon them for that deed, the first premeditated war of elfin folk upon elfin folk, whose name otherwise were glorious among the Eldalie for their sufferings.
Little good came thereby to them, for they fell unawares upon Dior, and Dior and Aurethia were slain. Yet behold, Evronin, the nurse of Elwing, and Gareth, a gnome, took her unwilling in a flight swift and sudden from those lands, and they bore with them the Naglofring, so that the sons of Feanor saw it not. But a host of Dior's folk, coming with all speed, yet late unto the fray, fell suddenly on their rear, and there was a great battle, and Maglor was slain with swords, and my illegible died of wounds in the wild, and Celegorm was pierced with 100 arrows, and Cronthor beside him. Note 21. My illegible. The latter part of this name is quite unclear. It might be read as Mythog or as Mileweg. See changes made to names under Dinithil. End of note. Yet in the end were the sons of Feanor masters of the field of slain, and the brown elves and the green were scattered over all the lands unhappy, for they would not hearken to Maedhros the maimed, nor to Curufin and Domrod who had slain their lord. And it is said that even on the day of that battle of the elves, Melko sought against Gondolin, and the fortunes of the elves came to their uttermost waning. Now was naught left of the seed of Baron Ermabwed, son of Egnor, save Elwing the Lovely, and she wandered in the woods, and of the brown elves and the green a few gathered to her, and they departed forever from the glades of Hithlum, and got them to the south toward Sirion's deep waters and the pleasant lands. And thus did all the fates of the fairies weave then to one strand, and that strand is the great tale of Eärendil, and to that tale's true beginning are we now come. Then said Ailios, and methinks that is tale enow for this time of telling. Changes made to names in the tale of the Naglofring. Ilfiniol, page 221, here so written from the first, see page 201. Gweniol is used throughout the revised section of the tale, except at the last occurrence, page 228, where the form is Gwendolyn. In the penciled part of the tale, at the first occurrence of the queen's name, it is again Gweniol, page 230, but thereafter always Gwendolyn, see note 10. The name of the queen in the last tales is as variable as that of Littleheart. In The Chaining of Melko and The Coming of the Elves, she is Tindriel, replaced by Wendolin. In the tale of Tenuviel, she is Wendolin, replaced by Gwendoling, see page 50. In the typescript text of Tenuviel, Gwenethlin, replaced by Melion. In the tale of Turambar, Gwendoling, replaced by Gwetherling. In the present tale, Gwendolin slash Gweniel, the form Gwendoling occurs in the rejected passage given in note 13. And in the Gnomish dictionary, Gwendoling replaced by Gwetherling. Belagost. At the first occurrence, page 230, the manuscript has Ost Belagost, with Ost circled as if for rejection, and Belagost is the reading subsequently. Igualwarthen. In The Tale of Tenuviel, page 41, the form is Igualwarthen. At the occurrence on page 240, the ending of the name does not look like O-N, but as I cannot say what it is, I give Gualwarthen in the text. Dinithil could also be read as Durithil, page 241. This name was written in later in ink over an earlier name in pencil, now scarcely legible, though clearly the same as that beginning My, which appears for this son of Feanor subsequently, see note 21. Commentary on The Tale of the Naglofring. In this commentary I shall not compare in detail the tale of the Naglofring with the story told in the Silmarillion, chapter 22, of the Ruin of Doriath. The stories are profoundly different in essential features. Above all, in the reduction of the treasure brought by Húrin from Nargothrond to a single object, the Necklace of the Dwarves, which had long been in existence, though not, of course, containing the Silmaril. While the whole history of the relation between Thingol and the dwarves is changed, my father never again wrote any part of this story on a remotely comparable scale, and the formation of the published text was here of the utmost difficulty. I hope later to give an account of it. While it is often difficult to differentiate what my father omitted in his more concise versions, in order to keep them concise, from what he rejected, it seems clear that a large part of the elaborate narrative of the tale of the Naglofring was early abandoned. In subsequent writing, the story of the fighting between Urin's band and Tinwellen's elves disappeared, and there is no trace afterwards of Ufethin or the other gnomes that lived among the dwarves, of the story that the dwarves took half the unwrought gold, the king's loan, away to Nogrod to make precious objects from it, of the keeping of Ufethin hostage, of Tinwellen's refusal to let the dwarves depart, of their outrageous demands, of their scourging and their insulting payment. We meet here again the strong emphasis on Tinwellen's love of treasure and lack of it, in contrast to the later conception of his vast wealth. See my remarks, pages 128 to 9. The Silmaril is kept in a wooden casket, page 225. Tinwellen has no crown but a wreath of scarlet leaves, page 227, and he is far less richly clad and accoutred than the wayfarer in his halls, Ufethin. This is very well in itself, the woodland elf corrupted by the lure of golden splendor, but it need not be remarked again how strangely at variance is this picture with that of Thingol, lord of Beleriand, who had a vast treasury in his marvelous underground realm of Menegroth, the Thousand Caves, itself largely contrived by the dwarves of Belagost in the distant past, the Silmarillion, pages 92 to 3, and who most certainly did not need the aid of dwarves at this time to make him a crown and a fine sword, or vessels to adorn his banquets. Thingol, in the later conception, is proud and stern. He is also wise and powerful, and greatly increased in stature and in knowledge through his union with a Maia. Could such a king have sunk to the level of miserly swindling that is portrayed in the tale of the Naglofring? Great stress is indeed placed on the enormous size of the hoard. Such mighty heaps of gold have never since been gathered in one place, page 223, which is made so vast that it becomes hard to believe that a band of wandering outlaws could have brought it to the halls of the woodland elves, even granting that some was lost upon the way, page 114. There is perhaps some difference here from the account of the Rodothlim and their works in the Tale of Turambar, page 81, where there is certainly no suggestion that the Rodothlim possessed treasures coming out of Valinor, though this idea remained through all the vicissitudes of this part of the story. It is said of the Lord of Nargothrond in the Silmarillion, page 114, that Finrod had brought more treasures out of Tirion than any other of the princes of the Noldor. More important, the elements of spell and curse are dominant in this tale, to such a degree that they might almost be said to be the chief actors in it. The curse of Mim on the gold is felt at every turn of the narrative. Vengeance for him is one motive in Nauglodur's decision to attack the elves of Artanor, page 230. His curse is fulfilled in the age-long feud between the kindreds of the dwarves, page 235, of which all trace was afterwards effaced, with the loss of the entire story of Ufethin's intent to steal the necklace from Nauglodur sleeping, the killing of Bodruith, lord of Belagost, and the fighting between the two clans of dwarves. Nauglodur was blinded by the spell in taking so imprudent a course out of Artanor, page 236. And the curse of Mim is made the cause of his stumbling on a stone in his fight with Beren, page 238. It is even, and most surprisingly, suggested as a reason for the short second lives of Beren and Tenuviel, page 240. And finally, the spell of Mim is an element in the attack on Dior by the Feanorians, page 241. An important element also in the tale is the baleful nature of the Nauglofring, for the dwarves made it with bitterness. And into the complex of curses and spells is introduced also the dragon's ban upon the gold, page 239, or the spell of the dragon, page 241. It is not said in the tale of Turambar that Glorund had cursed the gold or enspelled it, but Mim said to Urin, page 114, "Has not Glorund lain long years upon it, and the evil of the drakes of Melko is on it, and no good can it bring to man or elf?" Most notably, Gwendolen implies, against Beren's assertion that its holiness might overcome all such evils, that the Silmaril itself is unhallowed, since it abode in the crown of Melko, page 239. In the later of the two schemes for the Lost Tales, see 1107 note 3, it is said that the Nauglofring brought sickness to Tenuviel. Footnote, it is said in the Gnomish dictionary that the curse of Mim was appeased when the Nauglofring was lost in the sea. See the appendix on names, entry Nauglofring, end of footnote. But however much the chief actors in this tale are enspelled, or blindly carrying forward the mysterious dictates of a curse, There is no question but that the dwarves in the original conception were altogether more ignoble than they afterwards became, more prone to evil to gain their ends, and more exclusively impelled by greed. That Doriath should be laid waste by mercenary orcs under dwarvish paymasters, page 230, was to become incredible and impossible later. It is even said that by the deeds of Nauglodur have the dwarves been severed in feud forever since those days with the elves, and drawn more nigh in friendship to the kin of Melko, page 230. And in the outlines for Gilfanan's tale, the Nauglodh are an evil people, associates of goblins, 1, 236-7. In a rejected outline for the tale of the Nauglofring, page 136, the necklace was made by certain Uvanimor, Nautar or Naugloth. Uvanimor being defined elsewhere as monsters, giants, and ogres. With all this, compare the Lord of the Rings, Appendix F, 1. They, the dwarves, are not evil by nature, and few ever serve the enemy of free will, whatever the tales of men may have alleged. The account of the dwarves in this tale is of exceptional interest in other respects. The beards of the Indrafangs have been named in Tenuvial's Lengthening Spell, pages 1946. Now, this is the first description of the dwarves in my father's writings. Already with the spelling that he maintained against the unceasing opposition of proofreaders, and they are eminently recognizable in their dour and hidden natures, in their unloveliness, the Silmarillion, page 113, and in their marvelous skill with metals, Ibid, page 92. The strange statement that never comes a child among them is perhaps to be related to the foolish opinion among men, referred to in The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 3, that there are no dwarf women, and that the dwarves grow out of stone. In the same place it is said that it is because of the fewness of women among them that the kind of the dwarves increases slowly. It is also said in the tale that it is thought by some that the dwarves have not heard of Ilúvatar. On knowledge of Ilúvatar among men, see page 209. According to the Gnomish dictionary, Indrafang was a special name of the longbeards or dwarves. But in the tale it is made quite plain that the Longbeards were, on the contrary, the dwarves of Belagost. The dwarves of Nogrod were the Naugloth, with their king Nauglodur. It must be admitted, however, that the use of the terms is sometimes confusing or confused. Thus, the description of the Naugloth on pages 223-4 seems to be a description of all dwarves, and to include the Indrafangs, though this cannot have been intended. The reference to the March of the Dwarves and Indrafangs, page 234, must be taken as an ellipse, that is, the Dwarves of Nogrod and the Indrafangs. Now Glodur of Nogrod and Bodruith of Belagost are said to have been akin, page 235, though this perhaps only means that they were both dwarves, whereas Ufethin was an elf. The dwarf city of Nogrod is said in the tale to lie a very long journey southward beyond the wide forest on the borders of those great heaths nigh Umboth Muillin, the Pools of Twilight, on the marches of Tassaranan, page 225. This could be interpreted to mean that Nogrod was itself on the borders of those great heaths nigh Umboth Muillin, but I think that this is out of the question. It would be a most improbable place for dwarves, who dwell beneath the earth in caves and tunneled towns, and aforetime Nogrod was the mightiest of these, page 224. Though mountains are not specifically mentioned here in connection with dwarves, I think it extremely likely that my father at this time conceived their cities to be in the mountains, as they were afterwards. Further, there seems nothing to contradict the view that the configuration of the lands in the Lost Tales was essentially similar to that of the earliest and later Silmarillion maps. And on them, a very long journey southward is totally inappropriate to that between the Thousand Caves and the Pools of Twilight. The meaning must therefore be simply a very long journey southward beyond the Wide Forest. And what follows places the Wide Forest, not Nogrod, the forest being, in fact, the Forest of Artenor. The Pools of Twilight are described in The Fall of Gondolin, but the elvish name does not there appear. See pages 195-6, 217. Whether Belagost was near to or far from Nogrod is not made plain. It is said in this passage that the gold should be borne away to Nogrod and the dwellings of the dwarves. But later, page 230, the Indrafangs are a kindred of the dwarves that dwelt in other realms. In his association with the dwarves, Ufathin is reminiscent of Eorl, Maeglin's father, of whom it is said in the Silmarillion, page 133, that for the dwarves he had more liking than any other of the elven folk of old. Compare Ibid, page 92. Few of the Eldar went ever to Nogrod or Belagost, save Eorl of Non-Elmoth and Maeglin his son. In the early forms of the story of Eorl and Isfin, referred to in The Fall of Gondolin, page 165, Eorl has no association with dwarves. In the present tale there is mention, page 224, of great traffic carried on by the dwarves with the free Noldali, with Melko's servants also, in those days. We may wonder who these free Noldali were, since the Rodolphlim had been destroyed and Gondolin was hidden. Perhaps the sons of Feanor are meant, or Egnor Varan's father. See page 65. The idea that it was the dwarves of Nogrod who were primarily involved survived into the later narrative, but they became exclusively so, and those of Belagost specifically denied all aid to them. The Silmarillion, page 233. Turning now to the elves, Beren is here, of course, still an elf, see page 139, and in his second span of life he is the ruler in Hithlum Hissalome, of an elvish people so numerous that not even Beren knew the tale of those myriad folk, page 234. They are called the Green Elves, and the Brown Elves and the Green, for they were clad in green and brown, and Dior ruled them in Hithlum after the final departure of Beren and Tenuvial. Who were they? It is far from clear how they are to be set into the conception of the elves of the great lands as it appears in other tales. We may compare the passage in The Coming of the Elves, 1:118-19. Long after the joy of Valinor had washed its memory faint, that is, the memory of the journey through Hissalome, the elves sang still sadly of it, and told tales of many of their folk whom they said and say were lost in those old forests, and ever wandered there in sorrow. Still were they there long after when men were shut in Hissalome by Melko, and still do they dance there when men have wandered far over the lighter places of the earth. Hissalome did men name Ariador, and the lost elves did they call the Shadow Folk, and feared them. But in that tale the conception still was that Tinwellant ruled the scattered elves of Hissalome, and in the outlines for Gilfanan's tale, the Shadow Folk of Hissalome had ceased to be elves, see page 64. In any case, the expression Green Elves, coupled with the fact that it was the Green Elves of Osiriand whom Beren led to the ambush of the dwarves at Sarn Athrod in the later story, the Silmarillion, page 235, shows which elvish people they were to become, even though there is as yet no trace of Osiriand beyond the river Gelion and the story of the origin of the Lyquendi, Ibid, pages 94-96. It was inevitable that the land of the dead that live should cease to be in Hissalome, which seems to have been in danger of having too many inhabitants. And a note on the manuscript of the Tale of the Naglofring says, Beren must be in Dorioth beyond Sirion, Ana Lacuna, not in Hithlum. Dorioth beyond Sirion was the region called in the Silmarillion, page 122, Nivrim, the West March, the woods on the west bank of the river between the confluence of Taiglin and Sirion and Ailin Uial, the Mirrors of Twilight. In the tale of Tenuvial, Beren and Tenuvial, called Ikuil Warthan, became mighty fairies in the lands about the north of Sirion, page 41. Gwendolyn slash Gweniel appears a somewhat faint and ineffective figure by comparison with the Melian of the Silmarillion. Conceivably, an aspect of this is the far slighter protection afforded to the realm of Artanor by her magic than that of the impenetrable wall and deluding mazes of the Girdle of Melian, see page 63. But the nature of the protection in the old conception is very unclear. In the tale of the Naglofring, the coming of the dwarves from Nogrod is only known when they approach the bridge before Tinwellant's caves, page 226. On the other hand, it is said, page 230, that the woven magic of the queen was a defense against men of hostile heart, who could never make their way through the woods unless aided by treachery from within. Perhaps this provides an explanation of a sort of how the dwarves bringing treasure from Nogrod were able to penetrate to the halls of Tinwellant without hindrance and apparently undetected. Compare also the coming of Urien's band and the tale of Turambar, page 114. In the event, the protective magic was easily, too easily, overthrown by the simple device of a single treacherous elf of Ardenor, who offered to lead the host through the magics of Gwendolyn. This was evidently unsatisfactory, but I shall not enter further into this question here. Extraordinary difficulties of narrative structure were caused by this element of the inviolability of Doriath, as I hope to describe at a future date. It might be thought that the story of the drowning of the treasure at the Stony Ford, falling into the waters of the river with the dwarves who bore it, was evolved from that in the rejected conclusion of the tale of Turambar, page 136. Tinwelland, hearing that curse set on the treasure by Urin, caused the gold to be cast into a deep pool of the river before his doors. In the tale of the Naglofring, however, Tinwelland, influenced by the queen's foreboding words, still has the intention of doing this, but does not fulfill his intention, page 223. The account of the second departure of Beren and Tenuvial, page 240, raises again the extremely difficult question of the peculiar fate that was decreed for them by the Edict of Mondos, which I have discussed on pages 59 to 60. There, I have suggested that the peculiar dispensation of Mondos in the case of Beren and Tenuvial, as here conceived, is therefore that their whole natural destiny as elves was changed. Having died as elves might die, from wounds or from grief, they were not reborn as new beings, but returned in their own persons, yet now mortal even as men. Here, however, Tinubial faded and vanished in the woods, and Beren searched all Hithlum and Ardenor for her until he too faded from life. Since this fading is here quite explicitly the mode in which that doom of mortality that Mondos had spoken came upon them, page 240, it is very notable that it is likened to, and even it seems identified with, the fading of the elves of later days throughout the world, as though in the original idea elvish fading was a form of mortality. This is in fact made explicit in a later version. The seven sons of Feanor, their oath sworn not in Valinor, but after the coming of the Noldali to the great lands, and the maiming of Maedhros, appear in the outlines for Gilfanan's tale. And in the latest of these outlines, the Feanorians are placed in Dor Lomin, equals Hisalome, Hithlum. See 1-238, 240-243. Here in the tale of the Naglofring appear for the first time the names of the sons of Feanor, five of them, Maedhros, Maglor, Celegorm, Cronthor, Curufin, in the forms, or almost the forms, they were to retain. And Curufin already with his sobriquet, the Crafty. The names Amrod and Amras in the Silmarillion were a late change. For long, these two sons of Feanor were Dumrod, as here, and Diriel, here Dinithil or Durithil, see Changes Made to Names, page 245. Here also appear Dior the Fair, also called Ausir the Wealthy, and his daughter Elwing. His son, Aurethir, early disappeared in the development of the legends. But Dior ruled in the Southern Vales, page 241, of Hisalome, not in Ardenor, and there is no suggestion of any renewal of Tinwelland's kingdom after his death, in contrast to what was told later, the Silmarillion, page 236. Moreover, the Feanorians, as noted above, dwelt also in Hisalome. And how all this is to be related to what is said elsewhere of the inhabitants of that region, I am unable to say. Compare the tale of Tenuvial, page 10. Hisalome, where dwelt men, and thrall Noldali labored, and few free Eldar went. A very curious statement is made in this concluding part of the tale, that those were days of happiness in the vales of Hithlum, for there was peace with Melko and the dwarves, who had but one thought as they plotted against Gondolin, page 241. Presumably, peace with Melko means no more than that Melko had averted his attention from those lands, but nowhere else is there any reference to the dwarves plotting against Gondolin. In the typescript version of the tale of Tenuvial, page 43, it is said that if Turgon, king of Gondolin, was the most glorious of the kings of the elves who defied Melko, for a while the most mighty and the longest free was Thingol of the Woods. The most natural interpretation of this expression is surely that Gondolin fell before Ardenor, whereas in the Silmarillion, page 240, tidings were brought by Thorondor, lord of eagles, of the fall of Nargothrond, and after of the slaying of Thingol and of Dior his heir.
and of the ruin of Dorioth. But Turgon shut his ear to word of the woes without. In the present tale, we see the same chronology, in that many of the elves who followed Beren went after his departure to Gondolin, the rumor of whose growing power and glory ran in secret whispers among all the elves, page 240. Though here, the destruction of Gondolin is said to have taken place on the very day that Dior was attacked by the sons of Feanor, page 242. To evade the discrepancy, therefore, we must interpret the passage in the tale of Tenuvial to mean that Thingol remained free for a longer period of years than did Turgon, irrespective of the dates of their downfalls. Lastly, the statements that Cum on Idrisaif, the Mound of Avarice, stands there still in Artenor, page 223, and that the waters of Aros still flow above the drowned horde, page 238, are noteworthy as indications that nothing analogous to the drowning of Beleriand was present in the original conception. 5. The Tale of Earendel. The true beginning of the tale of Earendel was to be the dwelling at Sirion's mouth of the Lothlim, the point at which the fall of Gondolin ends, and fair among the Lothlim Earendel grows in the house of his father, pages 196-7, and the coming there of Elwing, the point at which the tale of the Naglofring ends. They departed forever from the glades of Hithlum and got them to the south towards Sirion's deep waters and the pleasant lands, and thus did all the fates of the fairies weave then to one strand. And that strand is the great tale of Earendel. And to that tale's true beginning are we now come, page 242. The matter is complicated, however, as will be seen in a moment by my father's also making the Naglofring the first part of the tale of Earendel. But the great tale was never written, and for the story as he then conceived it, we are wholly dependent on highly condensed and often contradictory outlines. There are also many isolated notes, and there are the very early Earendel poems. While the poems can be precisely dated, the notes and outlines cannot, and it does not seem possible to arrange them in order so as to provide a clear line of development. One of the outlines for the tale of Earendel is the earlier of the two schemes for the lost tales, which are the chief materials for Gilfanan's tale, and I will repeat here what I said of this in the first part, 1.233. There is no doubt that the earlier of the two schemes was composed when the lost tales had reached their furthest point of development, as represented by the latest texts and arrangements given in this book. Now, when this outline comes to the matter of Gilfanan's tale, it becomes at once very much fuller, but then contracts again to cursory references for the tales of Tenuvial, Turin, Tuor, and the Necklace of the Dwarves, and once more becomes fuller for the tale of Earendel. This Scheme B, as I will continue to call it, provides a coherent, if very rough, narrative plan, and divides the story into seven parts, of which the first, marked Told, is the Naugloffring down to the flight of Elwing. This sevenfold division is referred to by Littlehart at the beginning of the fall of Gondolin, page 144. It is a mighty tale, and seven times shall folk fare to the tale fire ere it be rightly told. And so twined is it with those stories of the Naugloffring and of the Elf March that I would fain have aid in that telling. If the six parts following the tale of the Naugloffring were each to be of comparable length, the whole tale of Earendel would have been somewhere near half the length of all the tales that were in fact written. But my father never afterwards returned to it on any ample scale. I give now the concluding part of Scheme B. Tale of Earendel begins, with which is interwoven the Naugloffring and the March of the Elves. For further details, see Notebook C. Footnote, for Notebook C, see page 254. End of footnote. First part, the tale of the Naugloffring down to the flight of Elwing. Second part, the dwelling at Sirion, coming thither of Elwing, and the love of her and Earendel as girl and boy. Aging of Tuor. His secret sailing after the conchers of Urmo in Swanwing. Earendel sets sail to the north to find Tuor, and if needs be, Mandos. Sails in Earame. Wrecked, Urmo appears, saves him, bidding him sail to Kor. For this hast thou been brought out of the wrack of Gondolin. Third part, second attempt of Earendel to Mandos. Wreck of Falasquil, and rescue by the Oarni. Note 1. Falasquil was the name of Tuor's dwelling on the coast, page 152. The Oarni, with the Falmarini and the Wingildi, are called the spirits of the foam and the surf of ocean. 166. End of note. He cites the Isle of Seabirds, whither do all the birds of all waters come at whiles. Goes back by land to Sirion. Idril has vanished. She set sail at night. The conchers of Ulmo call Eorendil. Last farewell of Elwing, building of Wingalot. Fourth part. Eorendil sails for Valinor. His many wanderings, occupying several years. Fifth part. Coming of the birds of Gondolin to Cor with tidings. Uproar of the elves, councils of the gods. March of the Inwyr, death of Inwe. Teleri and Solosimpi. Raid upon Sirion and captivity of Elming. Sorrow and wrath of gods, and a veil dropped between Valmar and Cor, for the gods will not destroy it, but cannot bear to look upon it. Coming of the Eldar, binding of Melko, faring to Lonely Isle. Curse of the Naglofring and death of Elming. Sixth part. Eorendil reaches Cor and finds it empty. Fares home in sorrow and sights Tol Aresia and the fleet of the elves. But a great wind and darkness carries him away, and he misses his way and has a voyage eastward. Arriving at length at Sirion, finds it empty, goes to the ruins of Gondolin, hears of tidings, sails to Tol Aresia, sails to the Isle of Seabirds. Seventh part, his voyage to the firmament. Written at the end of the text is, Remainder of Scheme in Notebook C. These references in Scheme B to Notebook C are to the little pocketbook which goes back to 1916-17, but was used for notes and suggestions throughout the period of The Lost Tales, C1-171. At the beginning of it there is an outline, here called C, headed Eorendil's Tale, Tuor's Son, which is in fair harmony with Scheme B. Eorendil dwells with Tuor and Irilda at Sirion's mouth by the sea, on the Isles of Sirion. Note 2. Irilda, the Elvish name corresponding to Gnomish Idril. See the appendix on names, entry Idril. End of note. Elwing of the Gnomes of Artanor flees to them with the Naglofring. Note 3. Elwing of the Gnomes of Artanor is perhaps a mere slip. End of note. Eorendil and Elwing love one another as boy and girl. Great love of Eorendil and Tuor. Tuor ages, and Ulmo's conchers far out west over the sea call him louder and louder. Till one evening he sets sail in his twilight boat with purple sails, Swanwing, Al Karame. Note 4. For the Swanwing as the emblem of Tuor, see pages 152, 164, 172, 193. End of note. Idril sees him too late. Her song on the beach of Sirion. When he does not return, grief of Eorendil and Idril. Eorendil, urged also by Idril, who is immortal, desires to set sail and search even to Mundos. Marginal addition, curse of Naglofring rests on his voyages, Osse his enemy. Fjord of the Mermaid, Wreck. Ulmo appears at Wreck and saves them, telling them he must go to Cor and is saved for that. Elwing's grief when she learns Ulmo's bidding, for no man may tread the streets of Cor or look upon the places of the gods and dwell in the outer lands in peace again. Eorendil departs all the same and is wrecked by the treachery of Osse, and saved only by the Oarni, who love him, with Voronwë and dragged to Falasquil. Eorendil makes his way back by land with Voronwë, finds that Idril has vanished. Note 5. The words Idril has vanished replace an earlier reading, Sirion has been sacked, and only Little Heart, Ilfrith, remained who tells the tale. Ilfrith is yet another version of Little Heart's elvish name. See pages 201-2. End of note. His grief. Prays to Ulmo and hears the conches. Ulmo bids him build a new and wonderful ship of the wood of Tuor from Falasquil, building of Wingalot. There are four items headed additions on this page of the notebook. Building of Eorame, Eagle Pinion. Noldali add their pleading to Ulmo's bidding. Eärendil surveys the first dwelling of Tuor at Falasquil, the voyage to Mandos and the icy seas. The outline continues, for Onwe and Eärendil set sail in Wingolot, driven south. Dark regions, fire mountains, tree men, pygmies, Sarkindi or cannibal ogres. Driven west, Ungueliante, Twilight Isle, sick. Little Heart's gong awakes the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl. Note 6. Struck out here, the sleeper is Idril, but he does not know. End of note. Core is found, empty. Eärendil reads tales and prophecies in the waters. Desolation of core. Eärendil's shoes and self powdered with diamond dust so that they shine brightly. Homeward adventures. Driven east, the deserts and red palaces where dwells the sun. Note 7. Compare Cortirion among the trees, 136, lines 129-30. I need not know the desert or red palaces where dwells the sun. Lines retained slightly changed in the second, 1937 version, 139. End of note. Arrives at Sirion only to find it sacked and empty. Eärendil, distraught, wanders with Varonwë and comes to the ruins of Gondolin. Men are encamped there miserably. Also gnomes searching still for lost gems, or some gnomes gone back to Gondolin. Of the Binding of Melko, note 8, this passage from Eärendil distraught replaced the following. Illegible name, possibly Orlon, is ?Biding, in brackets, there, and tells him of the sack of Sirion and the captivity of Elwing, the faring of the Koreldar and the binding of Melko. Perhaps the words the faring of the Koreldar were struck out by mistake. Compare outline B. End of note. The wars with men and the departure to Tol Eressëa, the Eldar unable to endure the strife of the world. Eärendil sails to Tol Eressëa and learns of the sinking of Elwing and the Naglofring. Elwing became a seabird. His grief is very great. His garments and body shine like diamonds, and his face is in silver flame for the grief and lacuna. He sets sail with Varonwë and dwells on the Isle of Seabirds in the northern waters, not far from Falasquil, and there hopes that Elwing will return among the seabirds, but she is seeking him wailing along all the shores, and especially among wreckage. After 7 years, he sails again for halls of Mandos with Varonwë. He gets there because, only, in brackets, those who still, lacuna, and had suffered may do so. Tuor is gone to Valinor, and naught is known of Idril or of Elwing. Reaches Bar at margin of the world and sets sail on oceans of the firmaments in order to gaze over the earth. The moon mariner chases him for his brightness, and he dives through the door of night. How he cannot now return to the world, or he will die. He will find Elwing at the faring fort. Tuor and Idril, some say, sail now in Swanwing and may be seen going swift down the wind at dawn and dusk. The co-events to Eärendil's tale. Raid upon Sirion by Melko's orcs and the captivity of Elwing. Birds tell elves of the fall of Gondolin and the horrors of the fate of the gnomes. Councils of the gods and uproar of the elves. March of the Inwyr and Teleri. The Solosimpi go forth also, but fare along all the beaches of the world, for they are loath to fare far from the sound of the sea, and only consent to go with the Teleri under these conditions, for the Noldali slew some of their kin at Kopas. This outline then goes on to the events after the coming of the elves of Valinor into the great lands, which will be considered in the next chapter. Though very much fuller, there seems to be little in C that is certainly contradictory to what is said in B, and there are elements in the latter that are absent from the former. In discussing these outlines, I follow the divisions of the tale made in B. Second part. A little more is told in C of Tuor's departure from Sirion. In B there is no mention of Idril. And there appears the motive of Ose's hostility to Eärendil and the curse of the Naglofring as instrumental in his shipwrecks. The place of the first wreck is called the Fjord of the Mermaid. The word them, rather than him, in Ulmo saves them, telling them he must go to Kor, is certain in the manuscript, which possibly suggests that Idril or Elwing, or both, were with Eärendil. Third part. In B, Eärendil's second voyage, like the first, is explicitly an attempt to reach Mandos, seeking his father, whereas in C, it seems that the second is undertaken rather in order to fulfill Ulmo's bidding that he sail to Kor, to Elwing's grief. In C, Faronwë is named as Eärendil's companion on the second voyage, which ended at Falasquil. But the Isle of Seabirds is not mentioned at this point. In C, Wingolot is built of the wood of Tuor from Falasquil. In the fall of Gondolin, Tuor's wood was hewed for him by the Noldili in the forests of Dor Lomin and floated down the Hidden River, page 152. Fourth part. Whereas B merely refers to Eärendil's many wanderings, occupying several years in his quest for Valinor, C gives some glimpses of what they were to be, as Wingolot was driven to the south and then into the west. The encounter with Ungwelionte on the western voyage is curious. It is said in the tale of the Sun and Moon that Melko held the north and Ungweliant the sea, C1-182-200. In C, we meet again the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl, said to be Idril, though this was struck out, note 6, awakened by Little Heart's gong. Compare the account of Little Heart in The Cottage of Lost Play, 1:15. He sailed in Wingolot with Eärendil in that last voyage wherein they sought for Kor. It was the ringing of this gong on the shadowy seas that awoke the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl that stands far out to west in the Twilight Isles. In The Coming of the Valar, it is said that the Twilight Isles float on the shadowy seas, and the Tower of Pearl rises pale upon their most western cape, 1:68. Compare 1:125. But there is no other mention in C of Littleheart, Boronwe's son, as a companion of Eärendil, though he was named earlier in the outline, in a rejected phrase, as present at the mouths of Sirion, see note 5, and in the tale of the Naglofring, page 228, Ailios says that none still living have seen the Naglofring save only Littleheart, son of Bronwëg, where save only is an emendation from not even. Fifth and sixth parts. In C, we meet the image of Eärendil's shoes shining from the dust of diamonds in Kor, an image that was to survive, the Silmarillion, page 248. He walked in the deserted ways of Tirion, and the dust upon his raiment and his shoes was a dust of diamonds, and he shone and glistened as he climbed the long white stairs. But in the Silmarillion, Tirion was deserted because it was a time of festival, and well-nigh all the elven folk were gone to Valimar, or were gathered in the halls of Manwë upon Taniquetil. Here, on the other hand, it seems at least strongly implied in both B and C, that Kor was empty because the elves of Valinor had departed into the great lands, as a result of the tidings brought by the birds of Gondolin. In these very early narrative schemes, there is no mention of Eärendil's speaking to the Valar as the ambassador of elves and men, the Silmarillion, page 249. And we can only conclude, extraordinary as the conclusion is, that Eärendil's great western voyage, though he attained his goal, was fruitless, that he was not the agent of the aid that did indeed come out of Valinor to the elves of the great lands, and, most curious of all, that Ulmo's designs for Tuor had no issue. In fact, my father actually wrote in the 1930 version of the Silmarillion, "Thus it was that the many emissaries of the gnomes in after days came never back to Valinor, save one, and he came too late." The words, "and he came too late," were changed to "the mightiest mariner of song," and this is the phrase that is found in the Silmarillion, page 102. It is unfortunately never made clear in the earliest writings what was Ulmo's purpose in bidding Eärendil sail to Kor, for which he had been saved from the ruin of Gondolin. What would he have achieved had he come to Kor in time, more than in the event did take place after the coming of tidings from Gondolin, the march of the elves into the great lands? In a curious note in C, not associated with the present outline, my father asked, "How did King Turgon's messengers get to Valinor or gain the gods' consent?" And answered, "His messengers never got there. Ulmo, sick, but the birds..."